Hi, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to the Austrian Circle. This is the program where we talk about the economics of freedom here on WHUS Stores 91.7 FM. So thank you very much for tuning into my show this morning. I have a very special guest on the show today. His name is Devin Keener, and he is a newspaper writer here at UConn. He's a student with you guys. And so I wanted to have him on the show to talk a little bit about libertarianism and his background in that. So Devin, thank you so much for coming on the show.
No, thanks for having me.
So maybe you could introduce yourself a little bit to our audience and tell us a little bit about your background and where you're at in the ideas that you've come to understand.
Okay, so I'm a communications major here at UConn. So, you know, I'm very interested in journalism and public relations. But specifically, I'm interested about going into politics. And the reason is, I think, you know, there's some really important things going on that people aren't paying attention to. And I think that is the effect that the government has on, you know, everyday people like you and me, the way that it affects our wallet, the way that it affects economic growth, and the way that it affects, you know, really our personal lives. And so I started writing articles in the Daily Campus, you know, I think it was the beginning of last year. And I think I came out with some pretty interesting stuff. And then eventually I actually ended up working on a political campaign because of my writing.
Yeah, and I read your work in the newspaper, and I was very impressed by your understanding of libertarianism, of your understanding of the non-aggression principle and non-initiation of force against other people and their property. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about with you the philosophy of liberty. And how did you come about these ideas? Like, what kind of inspired you to take a little bit more of a look under the hood and find a little bit more about economics and the ideas of liberty?
Yeah, so I was a young kid, and I said something to my father once, which was, you know, doesn't it make sense for the government to tax the rich? Now, my dad tried not to talk about politics around my brother or I, but, you know, he just kind of politely suggested, you know, what if the rich don't spend that money then, and some people lose their jobs? And now that's a, you know, a real oversimplification, but it really got me thinking, you know, what if there are unintended consequences to government action? What if, you know, my good intentions aren't enough? And that's what really got me thinking about libertarianism, because it's really, your actions have consequences.
Yeah, it seems like a great idea. We just, you know, we take some money from people who have too much money, we send it over to the people who don't have as much money, and then everybody's more prosperous as a result. But what that kind of neglects is the wealth creation process that the rich people really kind of put into place. They invest their money into capital goods that allow us to be more productive, and as a result, each worker is more productive, and then we have more goods and services available for people, you know, kind of in the economy. And that's overlooked when we kind of just say, well, let's just take money in here and give it over there. And it's really about the unseen consequences that brought me to these ideas that you mentioned.
Yeah, I think the way that I like to describe what you just talked about is that the wealthy play a role in the allocation of capital. That is basically their role in the economy. It doesn't matter whether you made your money yourself or even if you inherited it. That's something people like to complain about. You can still hire an investment manager and allocate that capital. So if we're going to get rid of rich people, if we're going to, you know, put a ceiling on how much you can make or take money away from them, we have to find another way to allocate that capital. And there's not a better system to do that. Government can't handle it.
Right. There's the incentives behind that. I mean, I want to certainly make as much as I possibly can. And when I'm hindered from doing so, or when there's a cap, when I'm unable to exceed a certain amount that I'm making, then I don't really get inspired to go out and create new innovative ideas and try and attract new customers to me. I'm just blocked from doing that because the government has set up hindrances that don't really allow me to do that.
Yeah, a great example is Elon Musk. I don't know how much you know about him, but he was one of the people that created PayPal, and he's a billionaire now. And what he's done since then is he started Tesla Motors, an electric car company, SpaceX, which created the first, you know, private spacecraft to dock with the International Space Station, and Solar City, which is basically a way to lease solar panels to get cheap solar energy, you know, without having to pay huge upfront costs, making clean energy available to more people. So if we had removed his wealth, if we had put a cap on how much he could make, what were his incentives to do those, you know, three extra companies after PayPal? And I don't think there's a good answer for that. I think we need people like that.
Yeah, absolutely. The entrepreneurs really kind of brought about all of the wealth that we see and that we take advantage of in this country today. It's with them that they brought prices down through their innovation, through their contributions to capital. You know, a lot of people talk about the robber barons back in the 1800s, how terrible they were and how they took advantage mm-hmm. of their customers and tried to price other competitors out of the market. But what they really did, and empirically, they brought the price of essential goods down so that they were affordable by general people, and that enhanced the well-being of pretty much everybody back then.
Yeah, we saw one of the greatest increases in the standard of living in human history during the Gilded Age robber baron periods. These periods that progressives like to demonize were really some of the best, you know, for human development. And I think another thing that a good point that I just want to get at is you said they brought prices down. And I think that's what capitalism does in general. You have these people out here who are really interested in bringing wages up. They want to make sure people get paid more. But the way capitalism really creates wealth is by pushing prices down, keeping a downward pressure on all prices. So when you do get your wage, you can buy more with it. And I think it's short-sighted to get stuck on wages.
Right. And theoretically, if prices are going downwards, then wages are nothing more than a price. And so in a free market, we might even see way downwards. But the price of things would be going down even that much more quickly. So it's really about purchasing power. It's not about wages. Mm-hmm. It's not the numerical amount that you're getting paid. If you get paid a dollar, but that dollar buys you a Ferrari, then, I mean, that's a fantastic deal. So again, it's about prices going downwards that make us so much better off. And it's entrepreneurs and capital creation and growth that really bring that downward. And so what about this idea that kind of politicians can create jobs? It seems like, to me, the entrepreneur is the one that's creating the jobs. And we were just talking about how the rich people need that money to invest in their own business. And when that money is taken away from them, they have fewer dollars to allocate towards jobs. What about this idea that politicians can create jobs?
Yeah, politicians can create jobs. That's not the problem. They can't create wealth. That's the problem. I heard a great line once, which was, you know, if every worker was staffed in the army of fleet, we'd have full employment but nothing to eat. And it's kind of beautiful because, yeah, you can create a job, but that doesn't mean you can create an economy. So anything politicians do is really just a stopgap. You need a free market economy running at, you know, on four cylinders in order to really ratchet up employment.
Right, right. Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about the free market. Let's kind of define that a little bit, because I think people get confused. They think that what we have might be a free market, and they look at these monolithic corporations, and they see them kind of taking advantage of their customers, you know, prices going up. The healthcare industry is a really good example of that. They see these huge insurance companies that constantly cost more and more, and yet their services are kind of degrading, and you get less, and prices are going through the roof. And so they think of that as the free market, and they say, wow, I don't really like that. That's kind of scary. So let's talk a little bit about the free market versus what we currently have, which I would define more as corporatism, or corporations that use the government to benefit themselves and create a monopoly for themselves.
Yeah, so I think one of the important things to look at is when you see a troubled industry, healthcare, education, housing, is to see how much government is already involved. We know that, you know, government was behind the 2008, you know, housing bubble and the recession that followed it. We know government policy through the Federal Reserve and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac directly led to that collapse. Ron Paul was talking about it on the, you know, congressional floor back in 2003, that some point during this decade there was going to be a recession. So this isn't, you know, rocket science. The same thing with the healthcare industry. We already have government creating massively problematic incentives. So an example is third-party providers increase costs. So if we have insurance companies providing healthcare, that's a problem. So then the government incentivizes employers to provide insurance for you. So now your employer is picking your insurance company that's picking your health and your healthcare. And with Obamacare, we now have the government telling your employer what healthcare to pick for you to use to get healthcare. So that's not a free market. That is, you know, basically three or four steps removed from a free market. And it's government that's incentivizing this with our tax structure, which rewards companies for providing health care, in health insurance, instead of just letting me keep my money and decide how to spend it. And that's one of the big problems with health care.
Right. It kind of masks the price. You no longer know exactly what the price is because you have other organizations that you have to kind of step through in order to figure out what the prices are. And there's no competition in that way. When I want to buy, say, a television, I would go and research the different brands and I would say, well, this price is around here and this has this many features and this is what I'd kind of like, but I can't really fit it here. So, you know, I'd research and I'd look into the price structure of these different brands and companies. But with healthcare, you don't really have that. You have these insurance companies that get billed for the actual money. You know, for the same procedure, you might pay $400 here or $2,000, you know, $3,000 here, but you never actually get to see the difference between those prices as the customer, as the person who's going to actually pay for that service.
Yeah, and another great example of what's wrong with the healthcare industry is you're not allowed to purchase insurance from outside of your state. And what that means is you can't have an insurance company existing all over the country with millions of users who can then leverage, you know, that buying power to get a better deal on medical services. So you have these states that are just stuck with the number of people they have. When you look at European countries, they basically bargain their entire population to get lower drug prescription costs. You know, they say, you either give it to us for this price for our population, or we're not going to buy your drug at all. And our insurance companies can't do that because they're so limited. So now the drug companies can play them against each other. You know, if Utah's insurance companies say, we're not going to pay this for your drug, a medical company can just laugh. I mean, it's Utah. So until we start getting rid of these laws that are preventing, literally preventing a free market from occurring, then our health system's going to be broken.
Right. And of course, the businesses love these laws. Mm-hmm. There's an old adage that nobody hates capitalism more than the capitalist, because mm-hmm. they have to compete. They have to constantly lower their prices. They have to increase the quality of their goods. They have to bring about something that's better for the customer to attract that customer over to them. Because otherwise, the customer is going to go to their competitor, and so they have to constantly remain on the ball and tweak their production process to bring customers back to them. But with the government, they don't have to worry about that. All they have to do is pass a couple laws, and then they become the sole provider in that particular market, whichever service that they're offering.
Yeah, it's worth noting that in a lot of ways, a return to a free market would not mean a reduction in regulation. In fact, it would mean significantly more free market regulation, because right now, companies can get away with a lot because you don't have a whole lot of choices.
Right. That's a red herring that's often brought up. You have no regulations if you have the free market. But in fact, we see the customers are the ones that are regulating the market. Mm-hmm. You might see certification companies come about in lieu of regulatory bodies, because people do want safety. They do want quality. They want a product that they can bring to their home that's going to be safe. And so they would look to other companies to certify it. And should that company certify a product that's poor, that's not very good, they're no longer going to trust that certification anymore. And that company is going to start going out of business or losing money. And we'd see those kind of solutions maybe pop up in response to people with their concerns about safety.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and I think where the free market really shines, though, is price control, setting a price. And when government tries to get involved in that, in particular, tries to regulate a price, you know, that's when things really go haywire. So that's when we talk about the minimum wage, or when we have government through the Federal Reserve manipulating the, you know, price of our currency. When you have government interfering in price, it's disastrous.
What are some of the consequences of those disastrous policies?
Yeah, so I already talked about, you know, the housing bubble, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and the Federal Reserve basically inflating the housing price, So the way that happens is the Federal Reserve is supposed to make currency cheap. It's supposed to make it so that you can borrow currency at a low interest rate. You can then go and spend this on whatever you want. So you can get out a loan, buy a house, and then you have a house. Maybe you can't afford the payments in reality, but it's cheap, easy money. You can refinance and you can do it again. And then you get a lot of competition over, you know, houses, and the prices of houses skyrocket. And then you can borrow more money on the new value of your house. And this continues. In a free market, this wouldn't really be possible. Eventually people would say, wait, hold on. You know, there's all this demand for money. they'd have to raise their interest rates. Without the Federal Reserve there to really feed the beast, they can't afford to keep loaning out this money. And so that's basically how the crash, the bubble that people like to talk about in 2008 happened. It wasn't greedy lenders who were just, you know, well, I guess it was. They did want the money, but they wouldn't have been able to do it without government's help directly. Another great example with the Federal Reserve is if you're bringing interest rates down, you're going to cause malinvestment. You know, if there's all this currency floating around, people are going to try to find a place to put it. And it's not going to be in the, you know, wonderful, it's not going to be in the right place. They're going to put it into a house or a stock. You know, we saw the Great Depression. You know, that was caused once again by the Federal Reserve making money cheap, making interest rates low, that allows people to really start investing in something. And that's when you get one of these bubbles. So when people are using government money to invest as opposed to their own.
Yeah, you've hit on such a great point, Devin. I'm talking with Devin Keenan. He's a writer here at UConn. And we're chatting a little bit about prices and the ideas about liberty and freedom and free markets. And you've hit on such a great point, Devin, about prices. And the interest rate is nothing more than a price. It's the price of the supply of savings that we have available to us as a community to invest into ourselves, into our businesses, into capital, into anything that we have available to invest into. The interest rate kind of tells us as a price how much savings we have available. And when we have more savings available, we can implement it into all sorts of different things. We can build longer processes of production. We can try and build things that are much more ambitious than if we only have a little bit of savings available to us. And this should be determined by how much people save. When they save more, we can engage in ambitious projects. When they save less, we really have to economize. And that's what an economy is. Mm-hmm. We have to consider exactly what it is that we can spend on and what we can't spend on. And when the government distorts that interest rate, we no longer have an idea about how much we can spend in a particular area or not.
Yeah, early in the program, I said wealth and wealthy people allocate resources. You know, an interest rate is one of the mechanisms that they use to allocate resources. It's basically a gauge to say, you know, what are my priorities? This is what I can spend money on. This is what I invest in. This is what I can't. When government tries to print savings, you know, tries to lower interest rates, it doesn't work. You end up with malinvestment. People put their money where they shouldn't.
Right, right. Absolutely. So let's move on a little bit to, we have so many different topics to talk about. Libertarianism is something that we can really apply in any area of life. You know, the article that you wrote a while back, I remember it said, libertarians, why we aren't that bad. And I thought that was a funny way of putting the ideas of liberty, because we are the ones that are talking about really what is bad and what is not bad. We kind of go to the definition of what is immoral, what is moral, what is evil, and what is good. And what we call evil, the aggression against individuals, the use of force, the initiation of the threats of physical harm against other people is really problematic for us as libertarians. We don't agree with the idea that people should be forced to go to jail simply because they have a particular plant that some people don't like, perhaps when we're talking about the drug war, or whether they pay somebody a particular wage that's lower. And there's economic consequences to all of this, but there's also the human side of it.
Well, first of all, there's a couple points I wanted to make. I think to sum up libertarianism, don't hurt people and don't take their stuff is really, that's kind of what the non-aggression principle gets at. But I also wanted to ask, that was a blue versus white article, which means there was actually a response in the same paper. I was wondering if you read that in the title of that. It was libertarianism is savagery. So basically it was saying that we are basically the barbarians at the gate, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And I think that specific writer, his grasp of libertarianism was so weak that that's what made me use that title, Libertarians, Why We're Not That Bad. Because people don't really know what we're about, and they don't understand, you know, why we believe what we believe. A lot of times we just kind of get lumped together with Republicans. I mean, there's a lot of issues that we might agree with them on, but there's certain things we don't. So one of the things that I talked about in my article was unions. We're libertarians, they're not against unions per se, they're against forced union membership. if the people in a, you know, workplace want to get together, form a union, it doesn't have to involve the people that don't want to. And there's some consequences to that. That means nobody's paying union dues that they don't want to. But it also means places like Walmart, where they've been losing the union votes, the people that want to unionize could still unionize. And that's freedom of association, which is one of the things libertarians really care about. And so that's what I was trying to drive home, is we're not who you think we are. You know, we have a, what is really a level-headed philosophy.
Yeah, I think there's a large misunderstanding. A lot of people, when they think of libertarianism and, again, free markets, they think that we want the companies to do whatever they want. They can pollute, they can endanger people, they can put shoddy products onto the market, they can just do anything that they want. And that's not at all what we're talking about. We're saying that people should not use force. We are against unions only in the sense that they use force. And in no other way. Anybody can organize in any way that they want. They can mass quit. They can organize to accrue, you know, higher wages to their employees. They can do anything that is voluntary. What they cannot do is keep other people from assuming their jobs after it is that they quit or threaten to quit or go on strike. They can't use force to increase their wages, while they can argue for it that they should, and they can, you know, again, mass quit. But it's the use of force that we really have a problem with. It's nothing to do with any voluntary organization on the behalf of workers or any other members of society.
Yeah, and it goes both ways. There's time in United States history, and, you know, there's countries currently where if you try to form a union, you know, the government will send police in to shut you down if you try to strike. And there's been times in history where these are the things that worry me. I understand why people, well, I'm worried about big government. I understand why people worry about big business, and I understand why people worry about big labor. So let's reduce the size of government. Let big labor and big business take care of each other, because they'll have at it. And I think that's the best way to go about things, is to have business not take a side in the, or not business, to have government not take a side in these fights.
Yeah, and big business and big labor is kind of the result of big government anyway, because we were talking about how they restrict competition. They disallow people from entering into the market. They assume that money is going to be flowing towards them and not other people through subsidies and through manipulations of the interest rate. And so, you know, when we get the government out of that picture, I think that you would see a return to smaller businesses, much more of them, because they're much quicker, they're much more able, they're much more responsive to their customer needs. And so we'd probably see much smaller businesses involved in people's lives if we got the big government out of the whole picture.
Yeah, it's kind of entropy almost. When you have a large organization, whether it's government or a corporation, you know, it's going to get muddled up in bureaucracy. And so, you know, big old businesses, they can only last for so long without government, because eventually somebody kind of, you know, new comes along and they want to do something a new way that the older business never thought of. So, you know, the constant threat of competition, you either have to be the best or you have to, you know, die. Those right. are the options.
Right, which is why the companies want to get their competition out of the market. And the government is the most efficient tool for them to do it, and they use force to keep people from entering into the market to compete with them.
Yeah, and there's a couple of ways they do that. You know, one, you have licensing, permitting, which are both fantastic ways to keep your competitors out of the market, but also regulation. You know, they can have bureaucrats in Washington or at their state capital pass a regulation that the big guy can afford, he can deal with, but his competitors can't, you know, the little guy. And so that's what tends to happen. I read a story once, and I don't remember the specifics, but it was a man who owned a company that made road signs, and, you know, they have lights in them, and you just basically screw in a light bulb. And so what the state of Connecticut did is they required that you have a license to screw in those light bulbs. And the guy was like, well, this is stupid, and went to go take the class and found out that there's only one person in the state authorized to give those classes, and it's one of his competitors in the business that he's in. And so there's always, you know, you can't separate big government and big business. You know, there's no way to do it. They're in each other's pockets. So limit the size of big government. And then, you know, a lot of those things that you're talking about, big business, yeah, you can't be this monolithic company without help.
Yep, I think that's absolutely right. So in the short time that we have left, do you have any particular topic that you might want to talk about?
I don't know. I'm so fascinated by, you know, basically every political topic there is, whether it be social issues, whether it be foreign policy. I guess foreign policy is probably a good place to go right now, just because of what's going on in Syria, where we see what is basically an unconstitutional war being declared. Literally just, was it yesterday or the night before yesterday, I think?
Yeah, you know, and it's funny, Glenn Greenwald, the one who revealed Snowden for the hero that he is, he just came out and said, you know, you know that you're in an empire when the government says it's going to invade a new country and start a new 3-year war and it barely makes the headlines.
Yeah. I actually retweeted that one, and the other one, I basically went on a social media just, you know, brawl the other day, because all my Republican friends were like, rah, 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 and all the Democrats were like, rah, 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 if they knew at all. And so one of the things I reposted was that famous Star Wars line, you know, this is the way liberty dies, to thunderous applause, hashtag war in Syria, because it's ridiculous. Get Congress back into session and get a resolution. He just did it. And it's for purely political reasons, and now we're in a war that I'm not convinced we should be in the first place. And I will admit that this specific crusade looks, you know, at least more justified than a lot of the ones we've seen recently. ISIS is absolutely awful, and I don't see as many negative consequences, but I'm still not convinced. And I think what people need to realize is that these interventionists, ISIS exists because of our actions. We destabilized Iraq when we got rid of Saddam Hussein. We did the same thing in Libya, getting rid of Gaddafi. President Obama wanted to do the same thing in Syria when he tried to get rid of Bashar al-Assad, and that would have made things even worse. So what did we do? We armed the Syrian rebels, and, you know, I'm sure some of those weapons fell into ISIS hands. It's hard to imagine they didn't.
Right, and I've read that the Iraqi army that had lots of weapons and you know, equipment given to them by the U.S. government, some of them deserted or some of them fled when ISIS attacked, and so ISIS gained all of that weaponry again. And because Iraq was so devastated by our attacks throughout the 2000s and into now, they are devastated, and they don't have the capacity to fight back against this organization that is now coming in to take over part of that property there.
Yeah, and I think I don't want to be too hard on President Obama on this point, because when he took office, we were already in Iraq, but we left a lot of equipment there. We didn't destroy it, we didn't disarm it, we just left it there because it was cheaper, and that was irresponsible.
Right, and then they have more enemies. This is the whole thing behind the self-perpetuation of the army machine. They create the enemies, they arm one group, and then that group becomes the enemy, and then they arm another group, and that group becomes the enemy, and it just creates this never-ending perpetual war for perpetual peace, and it's very unfortunate. There's massive consequences, and we've even seen civilians already killed in Syria, not only ISIS members, but also civilians being killed, and that's always the result of war, people, innocent people being killed. So thank you so much for being on the show today, Devin. We're just about out of time. So I hope that people will check out your articles in the newspaper, and I wish you the best of luck in your upcoming career. I'm sure you'll make a great difference in the spreading of ideas to the world.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm glad you know that you had me on. I look forward to listening to your show.
Great. Well, thank you so much. Have a great week. Take care.